coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this special pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. I am currently bi-locating. I am in Las Vegas, Nevada, as this episode airs. And oddly, our guest in this first segment is right here in Nevada as well, Angela Thompson-Smith. We normally have her on. She is the author of Tactical Remote Viewing. We normally have her on to discuss the world of remote viewing, things like that. But tonight we are having her on to discuss the world of shamanic healing, another practice that she is heavily involved in. Welcome back to the show, Doctor. How are you doing this evening?
I am doing good. Thank you. And thanks for having me back on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the time, as always. I've been very excited since we agreed to do this episode. And you were like, I would like to talk about shamanic healing. I was like, awesome. We just did a whole episode with Michael J.S. Carter about Reiki energies, things like that. And I am a huge believer and proponent in such things. I have been to numerous healing sessions like that. It is amazing the way that these things work. How did you first come to the world of shamanic healing, Angela?
Well, not just shamanic healing, but the whole realm of shamanism. As you may know, some people know that I was raised in England. You can tell from the accent.
Yeah.
I was born in Bristol, England, which is right slap bang in the middle of Celtic Southwest. A lot of history. When I grew up, we had a river running by that had lots of lore, you know, historic lore. There were stories about two giants that lived in the vicinity and all their stories. Lots and lots of very esoteric stuff as I was growing up. Crop circles nearby, stone circles nearby. My parents used to take us out to Stonehenge before it was all closed in. Mm. And we used to go there for picnics and we'd play on the stones.
Wow.
And play hide and seek around the stones, my brother and me. And then go over to, very other sites. We'd climb Clay Hill and we'd go over to, all the sacred sites around the Southwest. We would go for day trips. We thought it was just places to go. I didn't realize until I was older the significance of where we were visiting.
Yeah, I was going to say at that point, was it necessarily, I guess, did y'all know the stories of Stonehenge as you were sitting there amongst the henge and things like that?
My parents told us a bit about it, that they were very, very old and very sacred. But there wasn't any, we didn't go and celebrate or do any special rituals. It was just a place to go visit and play as kids.
That is a very interesting point of childhood to know that, like, you got to go to places like that with regularity, not necessarily as like tourist fare, but just a part of everyday life, you know?
Right.
That's something that we bring up regularly whenever we talk about people who grow up near such things, even people of local indigenous population. To us, it's something to the locals, to those that have been there forever, it's just another day, you know?
Yes.
Go ahead.
And also with my family line, my dad's people came from Bratton in Wiltshire, which is where they have the white horses carved into the hillsides.
Yep.
And other esoteric history and loads of crop circles, of course. And my other branch, my mom's people, well, other relatives, yeah, it was both dad's side from Wiltshire and then from just outside of Bristol, where they're the Stanton Drew standing stones. My relatives came from around that area.
Interesting.
And they're a smaller version of Stonehenge.
Now, was there any history in your family or in your familial line of relation to any of these Celtic tribes, to Druidism or any kind of mystical background in that kind
of way? Not that I know. Yeah. My relatives, my modern relatives, were mostly sort of religious on one side and nothing on the other side. They didn't practice. So there was nothing really, but I grew up in that atmosphere of that there's more to life than just living. There's this all this history, which some, America has a history.
Sure.
Going back to the, the Native Americans, who, of course, have their own shamans, and their shamans are still practicing.
Yeah. Now, with growing up with these things around you, growing up hearing some of these things, I know in our previous conversations regarding remote viewing, things like that, you've said that when you were younger, you had some paranormal experiences that had kind of set you on your path to understanding things in a greater way, in a larger way. And that's how you ended up kind of experimenting in college a little bit with a couple of studies that happened, things like that. But at what point did you start down, I guess, really that esoteric path of studying shamanism itself, Angela?
Well, yes, I was a very intuitive kid. My mother would come to me and say, hey, would you run down to the shops for me, when I was about 7 or 8, because shops were just at the end of the road. Mm. And she said, oh, I forgot what I was going to ask you. And I would tell her. I'd say, you need this, 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 and this. And of course, I had out-of-body experiences from, the earliest was about 8, I can remember. And I would just get put to bed, and I wasn't tired. And I would say, okay, I'm going to go and visit Nana, or go sit up on the roof, or wander around the village. And I'd do that for a while until I got tired. Then I'd come back to bed and say, okay, I'm ready to sleep now, and go to sleep. And I would tell my parents. My mom said, oh, you've got a great imagination. But I thought it was something like dreams that everybody did. Mm. So I didn't think it was anything out of the ordinary until later, when I discovered that not everybody had out-of-body experiences.
Sure. Sure. And, especially at that young age, it's one of those, I've got a child verging on 8 this month. And it's something that I do not discourage imagination time in such a way, because I have had my own experiences, things like that. So it may well, and one of the things I have hypothesized recently, especially with remote viewing, is it in and of itself a separate state of consciousness, and when you start talking about, specifically shamanic work, things like that, a lot of the things that bring you into really healing modalities, stuff like that, you are kind of talking about the same kind of principle as far as consciousness and how you reach into that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I know there are many people who've gone into shamanic training not being particularly intuitive or involved in others. And they've done well, because I think all of us have that ability, not only just to do healing, but to travel. There are many, many, and I'll tell you a few examples later of some of the work I've done, not just the healing work. But I didn't get into it until, I'll just tell you one more
Please.
Thing, how I knew that what I was doing in the early out of body was a real thing, because I went to my headmistress's house in an OBE when I was in elementary school. And I saw all of this cut glass, all this crystal work. And I told her, children are very innocent and naive, So I told her that I went to your house last night and I saw all this crystal and glass. And she said, yes, she said, I collect all that. I've got that up on shelves everywhere. So I knew that I had really seen something real at that point.
And how old were you at the point of that experience?
It was probably 8 or 9 years old.
Wow. Wow. And how long was it before you, I guess, did you continue that kind of out-of-body work, things like that, until you started down the shamanic path? Or was it something that you refound later in life?
Yeah. Well, in my teens, I kind of got away from it because I joined a Pentecostal church, which kind of frowned on this kind of thing.
Yeah. A little bit.
Also, some of the journeys that I had became, I saw things happening like car accidents and that were happening the next day. And in my naivety, I thought perhaps, was I causing them?
Oh, sure.
So I stopped. I just shut down everything during my teens. And it wasn't until I went to do my master's at Manchester University that I joined an evening class. They're called extramural classes.
Sure.
And for the public. And I joined a class called Outer Limits of the Mind. And we all sat around in a circle, and the teacher was talking about unusual experiences and who'd had them and how many. So as we were going around the circle, people were talking their OBEs, how one person had an accident and they looked down and saw themselves lying on the ground. And another person had it during an operation and he saw himself on the operating table.
Oh, wow.
And another, you know, they all had these experiences. And I thought, that's what I do, but I've had hundreds. And I was worried that I would invalidate their one experience. Mm. So I tentatively started talking about my experiences and told them a few of them. And then there was another young man in the class who'd also had repeated OBEs too. So we were able to compare stories.
Wow. Wow. And that is out-of-body experience is something that I guess I first began attempting a long time ago. It led to a lot of dream work for me. I found that I was very able to basically program myself to go to sleep, to look for something, to look for an answer to a problem, things like that. But I was never able to achieve the disconnect. I guess the snapping of that cord, so to speak. I was always tethered.
And not everybody sees
right
the
back,
cord.
Pulled right back. And it was frequently that sensation of like I'm falling, you know, and I would be jerked awake. And it was interesting to me that I never could quite get past that. But it's, you know, aside from that, there are connections that happen with all kinds of things when you start exploring that, when you start going down that path.
Yes. Yeah. Down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. When did you first start with your shamanic experiences and learning the shamanic path in that kind of way, Angela? Well, let's start with describe the shamanic path that you've been on.
Yeah. Well, back around 2010, I'd been living here in Southern Nevada in Boulder City for 30 odd years now. Lived in Las Vegas, then moved out to Boulder City. And I made some lady friends who were also very into these topics. And one of them had been to a shamanic class in Esalen in California called Wisdom Quest.
Okay.
and Vision Seekers class with Hank Wesselman and Jill Kuykendall. So she shared what she had learned in that class. And my friend Claire and I said, we want to do that. So the next class that was scheduled, the three of us went out together to Esalen.
Oh, wow.
And we took a class with Hank Wesselman and his wife, Jill Kuykendall, They've since passed over, but the teachings are still available online. And I loved it. I just felt in my element. We became bears. We became energy. We became, so many exercises. It was a week long. With about a dozen people, a dozen men and women who were interested in learning. And I said, I found my place. So one of the things we did in that class was create our sacred garden.
Okay.
So this is a imagined basically in layman's term space where you can go and you can do your work. So
yep.
My sacred garden is now huge because I have so many places there because I not only do the healing work, but I help people pass over. I have a waiting room in my sacred garden.
Oh, wow.
And I started that because I was so concerned about all of these service men and women returning from war and committing suicide.
Yeah.
One time it was said that there were 20 a day who were. So yeah. I said, I'm going to go and see if I can be of some help. So I went to the waiting room, and it's a basically a room with rocking chairs that people can wait if they need to. Then there's a door and a big round window that looks out to a garden. So I went there and I found it full of these service people. And I said to them, why haven't you gone through the door? Because I'm able to converse with them. Sure. Why haven't you gone through the doorway? They said, they were full of guilt about what had happened, what would happen. Would they be judged on the other side?
Sure.
Which was what they'd been taught by religion in their religious studies. And I said, no, you will have a life review, but you won't be judged. There's compassion and there's love, and you can just go through the door. You can open it. It had a big brass knob on it, that you could open the door and go through. Gradually everybody went through to the garden, and I could see, I told them, I can't come through to the garden. It's not my time yet, but I can wash you through the window. And I saw them greeting their loved ones on the other side. He'd already passed over.
Wow.
And of course it's all imaginal. It's not imaginary, sure. But yeah. Imaginal is that it's created. These experiences are symbolic of what's happening. And then I went back again another time just to check in I call it the waiting room. And there was a soldier there from World War I. And I said, why are you waiting here? Why haven't you gone over? He said, I can't see the door. So I said, well, I can guide you to the door. So I took his hand. I put his hand on the knob. I said, I can't come through with you, but you can go through. And he did. But he'd been waiting all that time because he wasn't sure how to get over to the other side.
You know, this brings up a topic that we have discussed with a couple of mediums, things like that, that have been on the show, Angela, and that is the concept of the difference between a spirit and a ghost.
Yeah.
You know, were these that you were working with, were they ghosts or were they spirits?
No, they were spirits.
Okay.
Yeah, they were the spirits of the deceased.
Yeah. I find that, yes, there is a distinct difference between the two. Ghosts are, what is inhabiting an area or something like that. They are attached in some kind of traumatic way, possibly yes. replaying a yeah. memory loop, something like that. But spirits can follow people around, things like that. You know, they can actively be here still frequently because they're attached to their loved ones.
They're lost.
Yeah.
They're lost souls. Yeah.
Precisely. So the fact that you are able to identify that difference, do you ever have experience with the ghostly kind?
Oh, yes. And particularly growing up in a haunted house.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Can I tell you one more experience?
Oh, absolutely.
From the waiting room.
Yeah.
You know who Janet Mitchell was? Dr. Janet Mitchell worked with Ingo Swann in his early days at the American Society for Psychical Research in New York, did lots of research with him. And, you know, Ingo had, of course, passed on. And Janet was living down in Bullhead City and had become very sick. So a friend and I used to go visit her. And she would tell us about her adventures with Ingo Swann, the founder of remote viewing, and some of her experiences at the ASPR. And she said she knew she was getting close to the end. She'd been through treatments for cancer. And when she was getting really, really close to the end, I thought, I'll invite her to the... I didn't say that to her, you know, but I said, you know, a metaphysical sort of invitation to come to the waiting room when she was ready. So one evening I was just reading or watching TV. I forget what I was doing. And I suddenly had this feeling that she was there in the waiting room. So I went to the waiting room. I did a meditation, went to the meeting room, the waiting room, and she was there sitting in a rocking chair. I said, Are you ready to pass over? And she said, not quite. She said, I need to wait a bit and then I'll go. And I said, okay, well, whenever you're ready, you can just go through the door and you can see, look through the window and see the other side there, and which is represented by a garden. And she died that night.
Oh, wow.
She passed that night.
Wow. Now, how do you... when it comes to the waiting room, Angela, how do you sense the waiting room? How do you feel the waiting room? You just said that, you know, you were sitting there doing something else and you had the overwhelming sensation of the waiting room. What does that feel like for you? What does the waiting room feel like?
It's a little bit like people knowing when someone's going to call them. You go, oh, I know I'm going to hear from my brother today. Mm. You know, just an intuitive, it's very much an intuitive thing. And so the waiting room's there, you know, for whoever wants to go. They don't have to contact me. They can just go there and sit in the rocking chairs until they're ready and then go through the doorway.
Now, when it comes to not the garden beyond the waiting room, because of course you can't visit the garden beyond the waiting room until you're done with the waiting
room. It's my turn.
Yeah. Until you're passing through the waiting room. How do you access your garden? Because I know when I began my dream work, things like that, when I began the work of astral projection and attempting that, mine was building like a crystal cathedral. And that's still what I go to. I go find my guide that I helped create, things like that. And that's how I begin my dream work. But how do you approach your garden? How do you get to your garden? How do other people begin their own gardens, Angela?
Well, it was something I learned in the Vision Seeker classes. We did an exercise and we would lie down in a meditative state and let our minds go to a sacred place that we felt comfortable with. And I'd always felt comfortable in the village where I grew up, in Shirehampton, suburb of Bristol, where there's a 17th century house and all of these wonderful woods nearby and land and very, very ancient. So I used to go up there with neighborhood kids and we'd play, we'd build forts and we'd build, you know, we'd have games up there without our parents. I mean, that was the time when kids could just go out and explore.
Yeah.
And so when I had the intention to create my sacred garden, that's where my subconscious went.
Okay.
To King's Weston House and King's Weston Woods. And so I wandered around a little bit and came to a grove of trees that had actually been planted by the Boy Scouts. It wasn't ancient in it, but the whole woods area is ancient.
Sure.
The whole area. And it was there then that we had to find some animal guides. So I sat and waited. And then a snowy owl came, and a bear, and a python. And these gave lessons. So it was just a matter of sitting and listening and interacting with these animal guides, and then going off on journeys with them. And it was all part of the class, the shamanic class I was doing with Hank and Jill.
Okay.
And it expanded from there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, it does not take long when you're doing work like that, to build upon great concepts, if you have a good teacher,
yes.
excuse me, if you have somebody that can really enable you with those things. And once again, the as soon as I found the concept of building your space, you know, no different than my studio here at home, like, this is like a rabbit hutch over here, you know. And if you ever watch a rabbit or a squirrel, like, they are very particular about the way that their home is arranged, you know.
Yes.
And you have to do the same thing very much mentally and spiritually when doing these things. You have to be very mm-hmm. deliberate about building your location in your mind and in your mind's eye, because the sharper and clearer that image is, the better your work will
be. Yeah. And there's caves there that I can go to, the lower worlds and the upper worlds. There's a mountain there. There's a plains. There's big, great, lots of greenery. I mean, it's expanded. There's a harbor there with a boat. I can go off on journeys on my boat if I want to. I mean, it's like a ship with sails. And I have a captain there that will take me, you know, where I need to go. So, and all, of course, this is imaginal.
Sure.
It's in that sacred space where you're just generating these visions, basically, in an altered state.
Yeah, and it's almost like running through a one-person guided meditation, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, not necessarily that there's a script in that kind of way, but in the same kind of motion where it's like, okay, I'm walking down a path now, you know.
Yeah. And it surprises me very often.
Oh, and I was just about to ask that. Are there parts, because I've definitely revisited my location and found things.
Yes. Yeah. Same here.
That are new things that I go and explore, things like that. How does that begin to occur? In a space that you have built.
Yeah, just being open and exploring. I know I have an elephant in my sacred garden, and this elephant actually was a real elephant called Rosie at the Bristol Zoo when I was growing up. And I always felt sorry for her because she had to hold these children around on a thing on her back.
On her back.
And so I invited her, when I was thinking about her, I invited her to come to the garden. So she has her space now in the garden.
Oh, wow.
And she will take me places within the garden that I need to, you know.
Now, a minute ago, you were mentioning animal guides in the garden. And I think that's something important to bring up. Because much like remote viewing, things like that, I think that there, especially when it comes to dream, when it comes to visionary work, things like that, I think that there is a lot of subconscious and just above subconscious involved. So kind of learning those, I guess the easiest way to analog it would be like Jungian archetypes. Things like that, you know, kind of like dream interpretation to an extent. But how do you begin to decode whether or not specifically an animal appearing is an animal guide or a construct of something? Because that's kind of what I consider the things that I find in my space is like, ooh, my subconscious has popped something up in here that I need to address and go explore. You know, and that's kind of like whenever a new crystal pops up that's never been in my space before, it's like, oh, well, this has some interesting facets. I wonder what other parts of me it has to do with. and why it just randomly popped up in my sacred space. It obviously needs to be addressed, which is why it's here. But how do you begin to know the difference between, I guess, that subconscious construct of an animal and what it might mean and a spiritual guide?
Yeah, I have several classes, basically, you could say, of spirit animals. Some are animals I've had befriended in real life and have passed on. So they're now my cats. And then I also bring in, I've always had a love of big dogs, but I've never had the ability or the whereabouts to have big dogs. But they're in my garden, you know, the Irish wolfhounds, and they always come and greet me when I come to the garden. And then there are symbolic animals that suddenly appear. Like I was riding the elephant, Rosie, one day, and Rosie stopped, and there was a mouse on the path. And I said to Rosie, "Don't be afraid, it's just a mouse." She said, "It's not just a mouse, it's a mouse." And the mouse had all sorts of learning to impart, you know, lessons to impart.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, are there ever animals that appear in your waiting room?
No. not so far. No, just people.
Okay. Yeah. And is it mainly veterans, things like that, that appear in your waiting room? I mean, of course, like many, you said, many. You had invited your friend to appear in the waiting room.
On
her journey over.
There are people there that I don't know.
Okay.
Very often I will go and I'll say, "Can I help you?" You know, trying to be helpful.
Yeah.
And they explain why they're there. And I say, "Well, you're welcome to go through to the garden. You just go and open the door. And you can, you know, look beforehand and see the guard. Go see where you're going and go through." And they do. But I think there's a lot more go through and I'm not even there.
Sure. And that's an interesting concept to think about. Just the idea that, I mean, number one, that you have kind of put a spiritual guidepost, you know, where it's like almost a beacon of, hey, if you're lost, come here.
Yeah. And people don't have to ask me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
they can
precisely.
Just go there.
Yeah. And others can tell them, you know, and they can tell others. That's pretty fascinating to think about that. Yeah. You have created this throughway and egress, to the other side for other people to use.
And down the road, when it's my turn, I hope to use that too.
Now, with that in mind, how do you begin, I guess, to put the homing beacon on that gateway? How do you begin to, I guess, put the ripple of vibration out that this is here for all to use?
Intention and attention.
Okay.
So you intend something and then place your attention on it.
Okay. Interesting.
Let's keep it simple.
Yeah. And that idea of attention, I think is very important because it's no different than frequency. You know, it's the idea of frequency isn't just a sound or a vibration or a color. Frequency is also your thought. How frequently are you thinking in a certain way? How frequently, once again, with something like this, how frequently are you attending to that? Because much like any garden, you don't tend to your garden on a regular basis. It'll get out of control real quick.
And that's happened. I've gone back in an exercise to my garden and it's been overgrown and I've had to do some weeding.
Well, let's explore that real quick, because I've definitely had to go in and do repairs, polish things up, stuff like that, after states of disrepair, and life happens, you know, because I can imagine, especially the spiritual work, the spiritual end of this is not necessarily something that you visit on a daily basis, Angela.
No, it's as needed. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and once again, you know when the doorbell is being rang at the waiting
room.
Yeah,
and it's not something that just happens. It's, you know, I usually have an intention to go to the garden.
Okay.
You know, like with Janet Mitchell, I had the perception, the feeling that she was there, and that's why I went and checked.
And how often do you get that feeling that somebody is in the waiting room?
Not very frequently now, because I think it's become autonomous. You know, people can go there and they can use it as a portal through to the other side without me being there or aware.
And you know, that is with that thought in mind, something that I always ask, whether it comes to involving somebody else in a remote viewing, like an outbounder, where you're literally tying yourself to somebody else's energy with intent and then have to break that tie with intent. Do you ever have the situation where, after doing this work, after being in the garden and in the waiting room, that you have to physically break tie in that kind of way, Angela? Have you ever had? Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, there are certain things that I do, you know, when I finish an exercise. Sometimes I will envisage a pair of scissors and, you know, and I separate myself.
Sure.
But it's there to come back to. It's whole and available if I need to go there. Yeah. And I don't go often. It's not like it's a daily thing or even a weekly thing. It would be perhaps when I need to share some healing, do some healing work. Or I need some information, some knowledge, or just to check into the garden. It's usually an intention to go there.
Yeah.
And as I've got older, it's been less often, you know, during the classes, of course, I was going there daily, sometimes several times a day during the courses. But and just some amazing things. Now it's an as-needed thing if I need to go there for a purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. And I very much the same thing with my dream work. It's not something that I attain or aspire to every night. There are most nights I just want to rest.
Yeah.
You know, I want good 8 hours of sleep. If I could not go somewhere tonight, that'd be kind of cool. You know, even during a recent remote viewing camp, there was dream work one night and it was like, awesome. Great. I was really kind of hoping to like rest my mind tonight for the next day. Not dream work all night before I go and try to remote view all day. But even with that in mind, it's the idea that even the shaman has to take a rest.
Because
of course you don't have to, much like remote viewing, you don't have to be psychic to do any of this.
No, anybody with the right training and ability to get into an altered state can remote view.
I would posit even do shamanic work in this kind of way, you know.
Yeah, if they have the interest, otherwise
how do you begin that process of unplugging? Because that can be tough when you first begin this kind of work. It can be hard to not just be in that mode or not be looking to be in that mode. How do you begin that method of cutting off and relaxing from this kind of stuff, Angela?
Oh, you mean finishing an exercise and then getting back into regular life?
Yeah.
With me, if I do an exercise, sometimes I have a nap afterwards.
Okay.
I will deliberately, you know, go and take a nap. Or I will go do some busy work, things I need to get done. And that takes you from your right, you know, hemisphere work. To the logical side where you're really being very focused. So you're going from an unfocused state to a focused state. And if that helps.
And do you journal these experiences, anything like that? Or
I used to. I don't so much now. They're just experiences that I choose to go if I need to go and do some healing work or, you know, checking into the waiting room or checking into the garden. These are just basically maintenance stuff.
Sure. Sure. And with that in mind, what other facets can this be used for? Because, I mean, of course, there's the spiritual end of things. There's helping people with spiritual issues. There's helping spirits cross over and move to the other side. But what other aspects of life can the shamanic teachings?
And of course, the healing work, which I will do. If I hear an ambulance, I send healing. You know, and I live near an ambulance station, so a couple of times a day, sometimes it'll be okay. Send healing to the person that's needing it. And it's not meant to intrude. It's just to add an extra layer of healing and support and care. One of the most interesting things I did is, of course, I've done animal healing too, as well as people healing. Is clearing houses. You're talking about the ghost work.
Yeah.
You know? I was contacted about 8 years ago now by a realtor in Las Vegas who was trying to sell a house and just could not sell the house. It would not sell. People would walk in and walk out. And what had happened was when it was empty of occupants, the druggies had moved in, the drug dealers.
Oh, wow.
And they painted the whole house black inside. When they went into the house, it was full of drug paraphernalia in the house and the garden. There was trash everywhere. They had to do a complete renovation of the house. But it still had that very heavy feeling.
Yeah.
And they kept hearing noises and, you know, the usual stuff.
Yeah.
So they asked me if I would come in and clear the house. So I said, okay, I don't normally do that, but I will come and do it. So went there and I have my drum. I'll show you my shamanic drum.
Please.
I brought my drum.
Oh.
My friend Claire painted this for me.
Amazing.
And I had a tape recorder and I took holy water and holy oil from our local Catholic church. You can buy it in a gift shop.
Yep.
Yeah. I didn't know until I went to visit with a friend. It's holy water and holy oil. I can use that.
Absolutely.
And I had a couple of little sort of ghost hunting apps,
sure,
which were just to see if anybody there would contact me. But my goal there was to clear the house. The realtor stood in the kitchen. She said, just go do your thing. I'm going to stay here. And it was a very heavy atmosphere in the house. So I went room to room, drumming with the intention of moving the spirits on. I didn't want to harm or hurt them.
Yeah.
The energies that were still there. And I put the sign of the cross, and I'm not overly religious, but I believe the sign of the cross has very, very strong effects.
Yeah.
So I was using the holy water and putting holy water around with oil, putting the sign of the cross, and just moving from room to room and bringing in the, you know, different instrumentation.
Yep.
And I'd gone about a third of the way through the house when suddenly the front door blew open.
Oh, wow.
Just bang. And the poor realtor, she said, what's that? And I knew it was some of the energies there leaving. And I said, oh, yeah, it's just the wind. Don't worry about it. But there was no wind outside. So there was a physical manifestation of them going.
Yeah.
So I finished clearing the rooms. And then I went around the garden and cleared the garden. And I'd taken salt as well.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I put a ring of salt around the house in the garden. And came back in. And this poor realtor, she didn't know what all this was about. And she was very nervous. And she said, are you done? Are you finished? And I said, yes, I'm done. And yeah. I always wear my red, I have a red wrap that I wear. So I packed everything up and came home. And the house did sell right after that.
Fantastic. And you know, what's interesting, especially bringing up the fact of the intense drug use, things like that, Angela, we do not necessarily need spirits to be involved for that kind of energy to stick around.
Yeah.
Even the whole concept originally of poltergeist activity was the fact of it was an outward manifestation of an actual living, like, teenager, you know? So the idea of that energy is bound up so tight that it physically releases in a PK format, you know, in a burst of psychokinetic energy. So the idea that this house being occupied by people with, well, malintent, doing bad things, even just using heavy drugs in a heavy way.
And that alone, but I'm sure there are lots of other practices.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. But those energies in and of itself will bring things down to a very base level. You know, even clearing that energy out can be hard, you know, and it's not easy.
Yeah. It's not something I normally do, but I was asked. So, okay.
And how did that session affect you afterward? Were there any ill effects for you?
I don't get any ill effects from these because I separate myself.
Yeah.
I'll do a meditation when I get home and, you know, peace and light and love and compassion and come back to myself. I know myself. I know who I am, you know?
Yeah.
And so I can rapidly let that go and, be myself.
Well, let's explore that for a second, because that whole idea of know thyself is hugely important. Hugely important, just in life in general. The idea of, like, do you know who you are, what you stand for, what you believe in, you know? And when you're talking about specifically not just sending energy at a distance, Angela, but entangling. Yeah. Your energy with other people, things like that idea of knowing yourself in that true Socrates, Plato kind of way, you know, is massively important.
Yeah. It took me a long time into my 20s and 30s before I really knew myself. And it's very interesting that here in this little town where I live in Boulder City, a lot of people, particularly when I lived in my previous location, I'd lived there 18 years in this little house in Boulder City, and I had lovely neighbors, but most of them knew me as that nice English lady who lives in the house on the corner, and you know, we think she's a writer, and she always smiles and says hello when you see her, and you know, she's very nice lady. And she goes out to the senior center sometimes, and she goes to the library. Yeah. And that's all that a lot of people hear. That's who they know. That's Angela. Mm. Or Miss Smith. They don't even know I have a PhD. You know, people are surprised when they find that out.
Yeah.
It's taken decades to know who I am. I mean, I've always had an inkling that, you know, it's taken a long time to get to know myself and to know what I can and cannot do.
Oh, and are the shamanic gifts something that you readily share with anybody, you know, or is it something that, you know, you don't necessarily talk about with a whole lot of people until that kind of topic comes up, you know?
Yeah, I do offer some classes. In fact, I did a series of classes for IRVA last year, and one of them was Introduction to Shamanism.
Okay.
And you know, and then we also did a few shamanic things during the class, very low level stuff, you know, very light. So, you know, I have taught it, and I'd asked Hank and Jill if at some point I could share their teachings. And they said, of course, but I haven't done, because there is another lady, Cindy Reynolds, I think her name is. She's now carrying on the shared wisdom teachings online. Okay. So if anybody's interested, you know, they can go and check in with her. I don't know her. I just heard about her. And she holds like a monthly get together online for people who are interested.
Awesome.
So I have taught it. I have taught sort of basic shamanic traditions and what people can do. But I don't think I'm quite ready to teach it at the, because Hank and Jill have passed on and they didn't leave a forwarding address. You know?
Yeah. Well, and that can definitely be hard, you know, especially if you have been trained in a certain way, trying to build the protocol, so to speak, for others to follow in that kind of way. Because it's even as we typically talk about with remote viewing, there are so many different modalities of doing it. It can be hard to just stick to one discipline. And especially when it comes to shamanic work, healing work, energy work, it's one of those you're constantly picking up tools for your toolbox, you know, and if you're doing things right, you aren't just stuck to your favorite tool in the toolbox. You know, you're much like remote viewing, you're using every tool at your disposal every time if you want a good session, you know.
And you get to know your spirit guides too. Mm. And I didn't have a concept of those until I had done the shamanic training. And I bring in Buddha energy. And these are symbolic energies from these individuals. Kuan Yin, the Holy Spirit, St. Francis of Assisi, if I'm working with animals.
Yep.
I have a whole range of spirit guides that I can call on to come and assist. And I always know Kuan Yin is there if I'm doing healing work, because I start crying.
Oh, and I was just about to ask, how do you know when you have connected with a spirit guide, and how do you know which guide to call upon? Case dependent.
Usually at the time of the exercise, you know, if I'm going to do healing, I will say, who am I going to call in? And it's whoever's appropriate. Like, as I said, St. Francis of Assisi for work with animals, Kuan Yin for the healing work. I've called in the Holy Spirit. I've called in Jesus of Nazareth for compassion and love and caring. So it's picking the spirit for the particular work that you're doing at that time.
Yeah. So, it's a process of discernment, learning to understand the subtleties of things, I guess.
Yeah.
And do they feel different to you? Do they emote different things inside of you?
Yeah, each of them has their own energy that I can sense. Yeah.
Wow. And how do you begin that contact? How do you first recognize your spirit guides to begin with?
They've evolved over time. I know that when I was working in class and we had to choose some spirit guides, I chose Buddha in the class, Buddha energy, to come in and assist. And then over the years, the others, you know, and I've had past teachers who have come to me during when I'm doing a healing and will say, can I be one of your assistants? And I say, of course, as long as it's somebody that I really trust. And of course, most of those have passed on already.
And I guess, have there ever been any times when you were not able to leave or break your bond with the spirit?
No,
with the spirit
I'm always
guide?
Able.
No?
Yeah. I'm pretty grounded, and I can break the bond. You know, when I finished, I thank them. There's a little ritual for thanking them and to let them go. And they leave. Yeah. They don't hang around.
What?
So usually this is just me in here.
Sure. And you know, that is, I guess, is that something that whenever you're in session, do you announce that the spirit guide is with you or, anything
no,
like that as far as actualization?
I do the healing. I'm on my own and I do the healing.
And, you know, this has been a fascinating conversation for me, Angela. The idea of being able to dig deeper into the world of shamanic teaching, the world of shamanic healing, how to access these things and use them for, once again, some things other than just the typical uses, using them in everyday life. How do you, with our last few minutes, what recommendations do you have, for the beginner, the utter novice who would like to explore these things and find a deeper connection? And what advice would you give to somebody who is already on their shamanic path and wants to go to the next level, the next rung of things?
For somebody, a total newbie, find a good teacher, find a group, maybe Cindy Reynolds, maybe some of the other, there are plenty of people out there, but do your homework. Talk to other people, talk to people who trained with these folks and find the right one for you, because not every teacher is right for every student. So go out and just do your homework and maybe follow a few online and read their books, perhaps. Hank Wasselman has a whole bunch of books out there, which are really interesting. He was trained actually by a Hawaiian shaman called Hale Makua. And he would often bring Hale Makua into the sessions.
Oh, wow.
So I feel like I knew Hale Makua. And then once you've chosen, you know, sort of decide what you want to do with it. Do you want to do healing? I don't just restrict myself just to the healing. I will apply my shamanic training to even to my own path if I need to. You know, what do I need to do next, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So just use your wisdom and find out what's going to work best for you. And go and try a few groups. And if you don't feel comfortable there, then try something else. You don't have to be stuck with the first one.
And that is great advice. I think all too often, when it comes to any work like this, people have a very inside and out of the box mentality, and the fact that this is the box, you know, and it's a very, very defined thing that they're looking for, much like prayer. Where it's like, well, I prayed and what I prayed for didn't happen. And it's like, well, did it not happen, or did it happen in a way that you weren't actively looking for?
Yeah.
You know, could it have possibly happened in a way that you weren't expecting? And if you go back and look at that, you'd be surprised how frequently, yes, your prayer was actually answered. You just were not paying attention to the helicopter that flew over you. Things like that. So, learning that path of not only discernment, but how to interpret those things, how to see them as they're happening in real time in your life. And it's hard for a lot of people, and it's hard on a lot of people to get to that point. So good, patient teachers like you, I think, are what is necessary with such things. I had the great honor of having you for about an hour as a monitor in a remote viewing session. And I bring that session up to a lot of people as a very, very big teaching moment for me, where I was exposed to a different modality of doing things and a different way of looking at and interpreting my data, you know? And those things are important because, once again, it's another sharpened tool in the toolkit that you get to pull out and use. So thank you for everything that you do with teaching, with passing these not only teachings but energies on in the universe, Angela. It's so important to have people like you that are out there continuing these teachings of great teachers. So thank you for everything that you do in that, right?
Thanks.
Absolutely. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to sign up for classes with you, where they can go to find out more about your books, your research, things like that, Angela.
Yeah, you can go, anybody can email me at mindwiseconsulting@gmail.com. And I do have a letter I send out with some of the things I do and things I don't do. You know, I don't do a lot of looking for animals now because there are just so many, and missing people, there are so many that I've had to cut back. And in my website, which again is mindwiseconsulting.com, and there I've sort of encapsulated a lot of the work that I'm doing and I've already done that you can check out.
Fantastic.
A lot of my all my archives up to a while back are over at the University of West Georgia in the library there.
Oh wow!
I was very honored that my archives would be accepted there.
That is awesome.
I'm continuing working. I had a serious, almost fatal heart condition 4 years ago, but I'm here, I'm working. These are bonus years. So I intend to keep working and helping other people.
Well, once again, thank you for all you do for everybody everywhere. I greatly appreciate it. And I always appreciate the time that we have together, Angela. Hold the line real quick while we close things out for this segment. While you are online checking out everything from Dr. Angela Thompson Smith and MindWise Consulting, everybody, please remember, stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can find all of the books from Angela Thompson Smith right there in our store. You can also find classes, videos, all kinds of things. You can also get your copy of The Curious Research Observation and Encounter Log. When we come back from this quick break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend Jason Quitt. We will be talking about astral work. We will be talking about astral encounters and his new book, Astral Encounters, when we come back from this quick break right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much to Angela Thompson-Smith for her time and her amazing knowledge in the world of shamanic healing. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like myself, stop on by True Hemp Science today. They have some of the most amazing products on the internet. Christopher Lynch, right here in Austin, Texas, creates an amazing CBD product using a spigeric process. He uses every part of the plant, from the seeds and stems to the roots to the leaves to the buds. Every part is used, combusted, reused, and combusted and reused again till nothing remains, providing an absolutely fantastic full-spectrum CBD product, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. Our guest in this segment is our good friend Jason Quitt. His website is thecrystalsun.com. We have had him on numerous times talking about alignments of the Anunnaki, all kinds of religious alignments in artwork, things like that. His new book, Astral Experiences, Journeys into the Heart of the Phenomenon, really is a great exploration into how these teachings of alignments, things like that, really relate to the world of the astral, to the world of alien, to the world of UFO, UAP, and so many other phenomena. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How have you been?
Been good. Pleasure to be back. And I think last time we spoke, we were doing the Gates of the Anunnaki, talking about sacred geometry and the gods. And now I'm going back to my old school. I call it old school because I wrote a book about 10 years ago called Forbidden Knowledge, which was all about astral travels and shamanic experiences and aliens in that world as well. And now on the 10-year anniversary of that, decided to write a new book, which you just showed, which is called Astral Experiences, Journey into the Heart of the Phenomenon. And this book covers about pretty much my whole life as an experiencer. So it starts basically as far back as I could remember, the first experiences that I started to have, let's say pre-birth and childhood, and then getting into this in my early 20s and how it relates to the phenomenon that everybody discusses, the astral world, alien abductions, contact experience, UFOs, portals, all these fun topics. And instead of it being from the perspective of the UFO phenomenon, as we're so familiar with, or ancient aliens, it goes from the perspective of the experiencer through the eyes of shamanic experience and traditional knowledge and, you know, what this was called thousands of years ago.
Yeah, precisely, because these things are nothing new. And a prime example of that is actually the MUFON conference that we went to in Covington, Kentucky and Ohio a couple years ago. We interviewed Thiago Tietchi, who is the sole MUFON investigator for Brazil, like one of the countries in the world where, like, it is just profoundly prolific. And it fascinated me, A, to have one person in Brazil that was investigating all that. But when I spoke to him about the natives, you know, like, do you ever get reports from the natives? Not necessarily whenever they come to town, because it's not like they do. It's a good 2-day journey via river to get to the city. But whenever you go out to talk to forestry workers, oil rig workers, things like that, and run across natives, what is their opinion of the phenomenon? He's like, it's no phenomenon to them. He's like, they don't report it because for them, it's not out of the ordinary. This is something that their shamans have told them about, that they've had in their culture for millennia, for generations and generations. So it's nothing strange for them. It's something strange for us.
Yeah. And I get that. Like, and this is why I'm so closely related to or like shamanism. Mm. And that's why I've been studying shamanism for so many years, is because when I first started having these experiences, I would go speak to, who did I go to speak to first? Let's say like priests and rabbis, right? Yeah. Tell me about what's happening to me. And both of them shook their heads.
Yeah.
Honestly, they just kind of smiled and said, oh, you know, just like, you know, read the book, read the book more.
Yeah.
So none of these answers were given to me by religious aspects. And then when I would go to my family and I would try to share these experiences first with families and friends, they looked at me very differently. They offered, you know, to get me a good psychiatrist, basically, because obviously if I'm having these experiences, something is wrong with me.
Yeah.
So there's this Western side of things that not only is it taboo, but it's fought against.
Yes.
It's like if someone, let's say, is born and they can see auras, you know, they can take that child to a psychologist or psychiatrist, and what will they do? They'll put them on medication. They'll say there's something wrong with this child.
Yeah.
But with the right chemistry, we can correct it, you know? So, and yes, there is mental illness. I'm not discrediting that. And, but I believe that there is this grand human design, this grand human experience. And there's a large part of that experience that is completely ignored and suppressed in Western civilizations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Specifically, the connection between each other and the connection to the world around you. You know, not too long ago, I did a symposium of the strange just a couple weeks ago in San Antonio about remote viewing. And that was one of the questions, was why does this practice come from like Eastern Europe, Russia, you know, why were they onto it before us? And it's like, because they're actively open to it. This is reading tea leaves, things like that are like a full on part of their tradition, you know, not just religiously, but culturally. And once again, it's the fact of these things are not strange to them.
Yeah.
So the idea is not foreign to them.
And I would even say that foundational religions or traditional religions are based off of these experiences.
Absolutely.
But they've been taken and then said, you know, I'm not going to name certain religions, but basically they said this happened thousands of years ago to these special people.
Yeah.
And therefore it will never happen again. You know, this is why we only have to listen to these people and these teachings, because they're the ones connected. And that is, I would say that's a trauma on the human race, because every single person is connected to these experiences. And because we don't understand them and we're not taught about them, remember, it also comes through our own belief systems and our own filter systems.
That's right.
So the way that we interpret these messages or interpret these contact experiences solely connects to what we're taught and what we believe and what society we're in. So there's a big distortion. And what I tried to do in this book is try to strip away every single dogma. Okay. I'm not quoting any scriptures. I'm not talking about other religions or other, I'm not doing any of that. I am giving the raw experience and what I thought at the time it happened. So you remember there, you know, the time it happened, I didn't know what it was. So, you know, I would say that, yeah, that's a demon or that's an alien or this and that. But after like 20 plus years of like learning about this and trying to go down that rabbit hole, my perspective has entirely changed. So I kind of go through that whole transformation of, this is exactly what happened. Like, I'll describe exactly the experience. This is what I believed at the time, and this is what I believe now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there is this kind of evolution that people go through that have these experiences. And I would say that the difference with me and why my perspective, I think, is so important in this subject is that I didn't come from the UFO background.
Yeah.
I came from the shamanic background, like you were talking about in Brazil.
Yeah.
So when I was having these experiences, I was very aware of what was going on. I was very aware of the steps. I was very aware of the beings involved in it. Hmm. And the entire, and I would say the process. So for me, it was always this kind of awareness of shifting into altered states, this awareness of leaving your body and knowing that it was not a physical experience, but it was a dimensional experience, and that we are, you know, a spirit living in a human body. We're multidimensional, and that we really don't understand the reality we live in. And it's through these events that show us our true nature and our true reality.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that is quite literally the path and the mission of the shaman, Jason, is not only to grow in that kind of way and learn that, the very elementary lessons that you learn early in life have very, very deep meaning and consequence later in life. You know, it's very interesting. Even whenever you watch the arc of a human being and, the way that, like my 7-year-old son says amazingly wise things. And when he's 70, will say some very childish things, you know, that full circle of the arc of humanity and the fact of we, you know, when you start looking at things, and that's literally the concept of the Montessori school experiences. If you find what that kid is into and encourage that, you will make somebody happy for the rest of their life. You won't be making a wage slave. You'll be making somebody who now has a connection to what they do on the daily, you know, and we in the West have a very, very different view of that connection of anything, whether it's family, whether it's work. It's very strange, our connection to these things. We're one of the only countries that, you know, you don't get 4 weeks off every year as an average worker. As a man, you don't get maternity leave off to be with your kid for 6 weeks after they're born. It's like, oh, great. Glad you had a baby. Congratulations. Here's a cigar. See you at work on Monday. And those things change us. They literally change the way that our brain is wired, and they change the way that our brain's connection to these things is wired. So it changes the way that we see the impact of them on our life.
Yeah. And I believe this is why it's demonized. Mm. It's because in our type of society, it has to function in a certain way to survive.
Sure.
And because of that, it has to be stripped of all these things. And this is why, even when we talk about plant medicines, they're shunned upon and illegal and taught that they're dangerous.
Yeah.
And the only thing that they're dangerous for is changing your perspective, you know, seeing the world differently.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to these spiritual experiences, remember, go back a couple hundred years, and you come out publicly that this is what you're experiencing.
Yeah.
What happens to you?
Yeah. You get shifted into a different part of society that is much more on the religious and, you know.
Or you're burned at the stake.
Well, yeah, or that, depending on the culture you're in. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
So I believe that there is this kind of trauma on the human race that they know for hundreds and hundreds of years, that if they would come out with this type of information or these type of experiences, it would be proof of something bad, and that you would be not only looked down upon, but punished for it.
Sure.
So if people did have these experiences, they wouldn't tell a soul. They would just pretend it never happened. In fact, probably in some places in the world today, if I was born there and I went public with these things, it wouldn't be so good for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we are fortunate to live in this society now, just with the internet and the connectivity, where we can actually talk about these things openly and freely. Yes. For now.
Yes.
But it's interesting because, when I talk about these things, and sometimes these clips go up on TikTok or something, you'll always get, or Instagram, where you always get people messaging saying, like you're going to hell.
Yes.
Or
yes.
In the Hindu religion, this is called this, and you're not able to do it because you're not a guru. You know, so there's all these kind of like gatekeepers of the experience that immediately when you say this happened to you, you get immediately resistance from a general public saying either you're evil, you're doing something not right, or you can't say this because you're not this person.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And you know, I have no problem with anybody's faith in the world, Jason. And the reason I say that is because I was very, very Catholic at one, to the point where I studied in the seminary. Like I was ready to wear a collar for the rest of my life. So I understand the need to be in a communal space with people of like mind. I understand the need to have a path shown to you that you may not be able to find yourself, because sadly we need people to stock shelves too, you know? And it's one of those, like, yes, not everybody is, I wouldn't say that not everybody can find this in this kind of way, but there are definitely many people that need a lot more help along the way. And yeah, I would tend to say that most of the, here's your religion in a box religions. It's in a box. It's very much in a box. The mindset is in a box. And at some point, the example I give is my experience with a shadow person that grabbed me. When I took that to my spiritual director, the answer was, we don't have a teaching on that, Chris. And I was like, well, that's funny. Because you tell me that there are dark things stalking for my soul around every corner, you know, be careful, be good. Not only is Santa watching, but Jesus is watching. And at the same token, you asked me to accept my faith upon spectral evidence. And when provided evidence of the spectral, you have no faith in it.
Right.
And that's a shark I can no longer leap at this point, because it's directly affected me. And at that point, it became the fact that I could no longer crowbar these things into a hole. I needed a bigger hole. I needed a bigger keyhole of reality to understand these things, because it obviously was not coming through just what was in the rubrics of the faith in the catechism.
And that's supposed to be the authority on it.
That's supposed to be the authority. So when I took it to the authority and you tell me you don't have a teaching on it, That bothers me.
Yeah.
You know, because it happened to me, and it's one of those, it may be explained to me one day what my religious experience of bilocation was that led me into the seminary. It may be revealed that I have a petit mal seizure disorder that only happens under certain conditions, Jason, but that does not remove the ecstatic experience that happened to me that changed the way I look at the facets of the gem of reality.
Exactly.
That day, in that moment, that religious experience happened to me and nobody else in that church. And that was another experience where when I took it to the priest who I knew, who was serving that day and celebrating, he was of a totally flip coin. He was like, I wish an experience like that would happen to me.
Yeah.
It's like, that is beautiful. That's amazing, Chris. Have you ever considered like searching for this in a deeper way? And that's when I considered the seminary, you know? So it's literally two flip sides of the exact same coin. So yeah, at some point I needed a crowbar or a larger hole to look at this reality through.
Exactly. And, you know, I started early on. I started before YouTube, you know, so I didn't really know where to look. I actually went to libraries and got books. I know younger people listening to this don't realize that, but
I need to pop the Dewey Decimal System up on the screen so people know what it is.
Had to figure it out, you know, to buy a nickel for a photocopy,
right?
Of what so I don't have to take the book out, just photocopy. But anyways, who could I turn to?
Yeah.
I found that I couldn't really turn to anybody. I didn't really know anybody. The only person I knew was a cousin of mine who was a psychic. And so when things would happen to me, I'd go to my cousin and say, this is what happened to me. And they would channel, or, you know, we'd try to work it out together. But that was basically it. And it was through her that kind of introduced me to dowsing first, to shamanism, to Qigong. And then from there, I started to go to these meetings where I started to meet other people. And what was fascinating to me is that I was so eager to share my stories with these group of people, because, you know, if I tell my friends these things, they don't want to hang out with me anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so I can't really talk to my friends about these things, can't talk to my family about it. So suddenly you get a group of people together that are kind of weird like me in a good way.
Yeah.
I can talk about these things, but the thing that blew my mind is when I would start telling my stories, they were like, holy, like, you need to like talk about this to somebody else. Mm. Like your stories are a little stranger than ours, you know? So I realized that, even in that community, I was still different.
Sure.
And so that's why people started to invite me to these, gatherings where they'd say, Jason, get up and, you know, talk about these things. And that's how I really started, was just getting up in front of like a small little community group of like 10 to 30 people and talk about my out of body experiences, talk about contact with certain beings and what they were telling me to do and how it led me to shamanism and Qigong and all these things. And, you know, still going strong 20 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and the experiences haven't stopped. They've just slowed down. That's all it is. There was this intense, intense part in my early 20s. And a lot of the book is focused on that early time in my life where everything started to open up and unfold. Mm. And now I guess I would say I'm more grounded in it, so I can see it with different eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've got the benefit of 20 years of practicing. You know, and using that knowledge and utilizing that knowledge and sharing it with other people, because it's one of those, whenever I taught religion and spirituality to junior high and high school students, it was one of the things that I did at the end of every year to let them know that, A, everything I told you this year may have utterly been a lie. Only way to find out is to go research it. Go look it up. Go find out for yourself. Never just take somebody's word for it. That's what the appendix is for. That's what the footnotes are for. Everything. All right. Go read the footnotes. Go look it up. Go find it. Go ask. Never stop asking questions. And number two, I have learned more this year than you have, because I had the benefit of 20 different teachers in my room, showing me a different reflection of this knowledge every time I taught it on a Sunday or on a Wednesday night. You know, the idea that it's being reflected in you. And as your light bulb goes on, a new light bulb goes on in my head of how I can reach somebody else with it. You know, and it's interesting that way. That is once again, the shamanic practice, the idea that you are learning more from the person that you're helping.
And right now, you know, when I got into this, it wasn't really about experiencers. It was more about contactees, you know. And then now I've seen the shift. Everybody wants to talk about the experiencer now. So there is this kind of shift moving towards the experiencer. Before, it was just like alien abductions.
Yeah.
And it was very much focused on, you know, literal aliens coming, pulling you out of your bed, experimenting on you, having hybrid children. I mean, that's been the past like 10, at least 10 years of the UFO scene. And now it's actually opened up. I think I spoke earlier about going to MUFON this year in July.
Yeah.
I've always been cautious about going to MUFON because I've always been afraid of MUFON. Mm. And the reason I've been afraid of MUFON is because they are very much focused on the documentation, the research into it, basically the nuts and bolts of the entire thing.
The exact words I was about to use.
Yeah. So very much a technological and physical. And for me, I always came at it as this is a spiritual experience or a shamanic experience.
Yeah.
And the beings that you're talking about, they're not physical in the sense that like they'll walk into the room. They do walk in the room, but you have to shift your perception into, let's say, another dimension to see them or an altered state.
Yeah.
And this is the whole divide. So this year they're actually doing an experiencer thing, and I'm actually on an experiencer panel.
Yep.
And I'm going to be talking about astral travel and the experience. So even MUFON has kind of gone into this side of research, which I find absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. They brought about the experiencer resource team many years ago, and that Kathleen Martin was a spearhead for that. She was a part of that for a long, long time. The late Earl Grey was a big moving cog in the experiencer resource team. And I have always been a fan of that. Whereas they had the star team, which was like, okay, so you have had something physically land on property. We're going to bring out like physical detection, all kinds of stuff, and things hit a different realm. That was very much the physical side. The ERT was the emotional side. How did these things change us as people? How do they change our connection? How are some people reporting things healed, all kinds of stuff? It's fascinating. And one of the things that I have posited on this show numerous times is the idea of vibration in all of this. Even if it is a physical craft, Jason, any craft that would do such things would need to vibrate at a very, very high frequency, you know. And the idea of that, much like any magnet near a watch, that watch will always be magnetized. Those gears will always be magnetized. Even if you use a demagnetizer, you're still exposing it to another magnetic field. So it will never tell time exactly the same way again. And we're kind of the same way, because we're 90% empty space held together by a quantum vibrational field. You know, once we vibrate to that level of being in that craft or being with the beings that seem like they walk through the wall, no different than the Flash can walk through the wall by matching the vibrational frequency of the wall. You know, like this is actual physics. So the idea that you've been on a craft and you are now changed and almost a frequency beacon in a way, absolutely. That is something that I truly, truly hold. And especially when you're talking trauma, Jason, to bring that loop full circle of conversation, there's been some amazing study done about the fact that trauma is passed on epigenetically in family lines. A lot of this research was done, there it is from Psych Central, about how trauma is passed down to future generations. And a lot of this research was done with like Vietnam vets, sufferers of PTSD, and seeing if the same epigenetic markers, because that stress on their body, things like that, like changed their epigenetics, and finding those same epigenetic markers in their descendants and their children and their grandchildren, things like that. So absolutely, trauma is fully and physically passed down. Much less spiritual trauma.
Yes. And this is part of the shamanic journey. And the shamanic journey is to come face to face with understanding that you carry the trauma of your ancestors. And that, you know, the first thing they teach you in shamanism is you heal the ancestors. Mm. So the ancestors you still carry within you basically pulls you on a certain path. So you have to first heal your ancestors through you. And then once you do that, then you can look at yourself and start healing yourself. And that could be from past lives, simultaneous lives, things of that nature. So it really is a journey. And I think that's what these experiences are. And when you're talking about these physical ships, even in the book, the last chapter, I know you haven't gotten there yet, but it talks about some channelings from the early 1940s, where it really talks about how these ships are etheric in nature. And that all they do is they change their vibrational state and they move. They don't travel. They just move into this space so they can materialize and just by will or thought dematerialize back into their realm.
Yeah.
So it's not really traveling. It's just shifting from one simultaneous experience into another simultaneous experience. It's just shifting through dimensions.
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. And, you know, I am of the mind that we do that regularly. We shift dimension regularly. We are in and out of it all the time. I've said for years on this show and in other places, it's quite literally where the world of imagination comes from, you know, where suddenly you're just struck with an idea and you can see it in front of your face. You know, that's the way I describe like circuits and other things and inventions that I build to people is if I can see it in my head, I can come really close to it.
Exactly.
You know, but
exactly.
I have to be able to like physically see it.
And like, that's
if
the
I can
Nikola,
physically see it, I can make it happen.
And that's exactly what Nikola Tesla would talk about.
Yeah.
He would talk about the mind and how that there's a place where all mind exists.
Yeah.
And if you can tap into it, then you're part of that mind and you can receive.
Yeah. And literally it is the concept of the Aristotelian, you know, the Aristotelian form, the fact that somewhere there is the esse qua esse of chair, you know, the being of being, like it is the perfect chair and it exists and it's out there in the universe somewhere. But because we're physical, we can only get, so that's why we always have imperfect chairs. It's why they'll always break, always rust, always fall apart eventually, is because this world is imperfect. We can make a tangible product that's similar to that ethereal chair that is the best being of chair that there is, but we'll never quite achieve it because of the physicality of this world and the material.
Okay, so this is, so I think that this type of information has a lot of value, especially now.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people that have these experiences, they don't want to share it, you know? And this is why the first book I wrote, the Forbidden Knowledge book, was taken down so quickly, because, you know, one, it was my first book, and two, I completely overshared, like way overshared. And so I wasn't prepared for like, you know, random people coming up to me and saying, I love that story of you and this person. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You wrote about it.
Yeah. You wrote about it. It was in your book.
So, you know, I realized and now if I did have to get a real job, they would see me on the internet or on YouTube talking about these things. I think they would pass over me pretty quickly. You know, so this type of information really does put you in a corner.
It can.
Yeah. So I've been in that corner for quite a while. But, I've tried to kind of hide it. And I know you've met me. You met me at the place of me doing the ancient civilization stuff.
Yeah.
And the stars, which is a very big interest of mine. But it was kind of like something to hide me. You know, it's like, I want you to forget about how I got here into this scene and all the experiences and all these things. Forget about that and look at this really cool information I want to share with you.
Yeah, well, because that's quantifiable information.
Correct.
You know? And that's just it. You know, once again, it's one of those, like, when it comes to the experience, capital E, capital X, you know, like that is an unquantifiable. It's like trying to, I just immediately revert right back to faith, because it's one of those, if you ask somebody what they believe, just accept what they believe. You will not change their paradigm. Nor did you base your question upon changing their paradigm. You ask them what they believe and why they believe it. Yeah. And that doesn't matter if you go to the same church, that answer is different for every single person that walks in that door, you know, and that's a very, very personal thing. I personally, just from knowing you and seeing this arc of work of yours, Jason, it is the fact of, I would say that the alignment work is somewhat of a beard for you, because it's this deep shamanic work that led you to that to Correct. Begin with, and trying to crack open the different messages that were left behind by the shamanic elders in these various societies so that you can see the universal message amongst all of them.
Exactly. And it does always go back to the axiom, as above, so below.
Yeah.
And what I'm realizing now is that there are certain laws that happen, let's say in the shamanic world, so astral travel, contact with beings, there's these laws. But then we have the laws of physical reality and manifestation. But we never understand how the two connect, or the how do we bridge the spirit and matter, and do the law. Like, for example, when I leave my body, sometimes there will be an actual portal there. Sure. You can go through the portal and jump to places. Now, if portals exist in that astral space, in that dimension, could they exist physically on Earth? Is there a law that says that this can actually happen here physically? And the more I'm looking into this, yes, everything actually exists on this level and on that level, but how do we access it? So yeah. There's this,
yeah,
I would say, this science now, and I think we're starting to learn about it now through quantum teleportation.
Yep.
Quantum entanglement. We're starting to learn about these things physically and how these things work and operate in our physical dimension. But when we're in the spiritual dimension, they just work. It's kind of, that's the operations over there. And now we're learning about it at the quantum level over here.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And it's interesting. The one thing that I show whenever I speak at remote viewing conferences is the fact of the entanglement principle, the idea that we can, that spooky action at a distance that Einstein theorized about, that has now been proven. And when you look at the image, and I'll search it up and bring it up, but when you look at the image of two electrons entangled, it's literally a yin-yang. Like, I'd love to say it kind of looks like a yin-yang. You could interpret it as a yin-yang. It's a friggin' yin-yang. Yeah. Like, it is an exact yin-yang, the symbol of balance and Zen that has been used in Buddhism for millennia, for thousands of years.
And the photon is a Celtic cross.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to see that, you know, the fact that here is an ancient wisdom that talks about this and the idea that we are all connected. We're all connected, good and bad. All these things are interwoven together. And quantum physics just goes right on and kind of proves that with the concept of entanglement at a distance and the fact that two particles can influence each other despite distance. Sets forth the path of, if that's the case, then you could totally remote influence something. That yeah. means that, yes, remote viewing, absolutely possible, you know, even
telepathy, yeah. empathy. It's all related. And the whole thing now with the quantum computing system of the quarks, it all has to do with simultaneous dimensions or simultaneous existence.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to, see how perfect that is?
Like, it is an exact yin-yang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is, like I said, the whole concept of the as above, so below. And this is also the concept of sacred geometry.
That's right.
Is that there is repeating patterns at different levels from the microcosm to the macrocosm that follow certain laws of pattern, that things will align in a very specific way due to vibration. And it's from that sacred geometry that you learn about the building blocks of life or learn about spiritual existence. I mean, And this is why it goes into this kind of fractal knowledge where everything is true and nothing is true. It doesn't matter what form of research you get into, it doesn't matter because it's all part of that fractal nature of creation.
Yeah.
So you're kind of stuck within it. It doesn't matter what you think or believe.
Yeah. And you know, what's really interesting is it goes merrily along without you. You
right.
know, we influence the world around us, all kinds of things. Even the idea of like, sure, you can remote view an event in the future because, well, time is one of the only made up concepts in science. You know, like it literally doesn't exist. We've decided that 60 seconds is a minute, 60 minutes is an hour. You need a totally different. I literally posted an article this morning before this interview about how they are getting ready to set a time zone for the moon because Luna, like you're going to need one. You're getting ready to build bases up there and you got to communicate with people. And lunar time is totally different because of gravity. You know, time on Jupiter is different because of gravity. It's relative to the observer. So at that point, that basically means it's made up.
Yeah, all it is it's a measurement.
Yeah.
And how do we divide things?
Yep.
And again, it's like when we were talking about sacred geometry, I was always, you said the number 60, which was a constant, a Sumerian number.
Yep.
That is the closest number that we can divide things when it comes to cycles and time, and the most accurate. And it can divide into itself by certain integers and numbers. So, you know, there is this kind of mathematical formula that our Earth kind of is regulated by. So for us, that's why we have these sacred numbers, these sacred geometries, because we live in that system. Now, when it comes to the other stuff that we're talking about, which is totally experience related or spiritual related, these things cannot be measured. And it still makes me laugh. I don't know if you ever had the pleasure of talking to Bob Mitchell back in the day. Mm-mm. But the original title of the first book was Forbidden Knowledge, Revelations of a Multidimensional Time Traveler. And he came up with that title, and it still makes me laugh today. But it is very, very accurate because it has to do with time.
Mm.
And I don't know if you've read the part in the book about astral traveling into different timelines.
Yes.
Or into the future. But
yeah,
it's like right now, as we're alive, breathing right now, we're in this cycle of time of Earth. Okay, so we're experiencing going forward. You know, we can't go backwards. But when you leave your body, suddenly that does not exist anymore.
Yeah.
And you can jump to other things, other timelines, simultaneous existences, other planetary existences, and come back here. And it makes absolutely no sense to us here. Because, you know, there's all these arguments, well, you know, that can't happen because of this thing or this law or this understanding. But it is happening.
Yeah.
You know, so how do we explain it if it is happening? Like, not every person is lying about this. They're experiencing this, but you're telling them it can't happen because of something that's held your mind in a certain cage.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And that is the importance of the word phenomena, you know, in science, is the idea of like, what is strange outside of the data set? Because you're supposed to explore that phenomenon. You're supposed to eliminate it from the data set. You know, that's one of the things that I've said for the longest time. I'm happy for the relabeling from UFO to UAP because it sets forth science being science and using science to classify things the way science does. And phenomena is squarely in the realm of science. I'll show you one book real quick. Here's a prime example. This is from a set of desk references from the 1970s. This is an actual scientific desk reference of strange phenomena. And it has articles going back to like the 16, 1700s on ball lightning, marsh gas, all kinds of stuff, things like that. But it's how do you account for that? Has this ever happened before? Are there any accounts of these kind of things? And that's what the desk reference is for those that are investigating such stuff. But the fact that there is an actual scientific desk reference of phenomena like that tells you how important phenomena is to science. You know, like you've got to be able to eliminate that from a scientific data set.
Exactly. And there is so many mysteries still out there. And I cover a lot of those in the book, especially in the later chapters. But these mysteries, it's like we're given very simplistic answers to these mysteries. So they're kind of like fluffed off and said, yeah, you know, even with sleep paralysis.
Yeah.
You know, when someone enters sleep paralysis, they say, okay, it's just this thing. And because it's terrifying, you're going to hallucinate. But why do people hallucinate the exact same thing across time and across traditions? It makes absolutely no sense why someone will see the exact same thing. They may interpret it differently, but it's the exact same scenario. And, you know, this is the thing where, you know, I talk about, I don't even want to go there. You know, a couple of days ago, they just did this hearing in Washington about UFOs and all these things. And one of the gentlemen there was talking about the different alien races. And they said the Greys and the reptilians and the mantids and this and that. And I'm like, it's very interesting because, yes, I've experienced all of those, but in altered states of consciousness, leaving your body. Mm. But what is even more fascinating is that somebody will go out in the jungle, even a Westerner will go out in the jungle, they'll take like a plant medicine or something, and suddenly they're in this trip, they'll see the exact same beings.
Yeah.
They'll see Greys, they'll see mantids, they'll see reptilians, they'll see these beings, they'll be taken on a ship, they'll be experimented on or worked on, and then they come back. Different, you know, but you have people with them there the whole time. So it's not a physical thing that they're experiencing.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're saying, okay, these physical beings are coming in their ships and take you, but well, how do you explain someone in the jungle that drinks a special drink and suddenly they're on a ship with these same beings?
Yeah.
You say, okay, well, that's a hallucination, but go back 1,000 years, it's the same exact thing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I at this point, because we've got about 15, 20 minutes left, Jason, I want to backtrack the conversation to an original part of the conversation, which is how a lot of people see these things. I posted an ad not too long ago, just boosted a thing as I'm speaking at the PsyGames conference this year with our mutual friend, Jimmy Church, all kinds of stuff. And immediately, it wasn't until I saw my brother's comment, because Facebook alerted me like, hey, you know, Randy Jordan made a comment. I went and I looked at my brother's comment, and his comment was just, these comments are gold. And I started brother, the first one was like biblical reference to the end times and how I am demonic for supporting remote viewing. And I'm like, wait a minute, though, you're giving me a passage from St. John the Revelator, who quite possibly remote viewed the end times. I want to cover this before we leave the shamanic conversation tonight, because how do you know that these things are not ill will in disguise? How can you be grounded enough to know that what you were journeying to visit, with intent or by accident, do not have ill intent or are trying to use you as a portal through which to come into this world?
I'm so happy you brought that up, because that's basically the meat and potatoes of this book.
Exactly.
Because I'm trying to teach people so hard. I'm trying to give the message that these things cannot be trusted. A lot of these things cannot be trusted.
Yeah.
And, you know, just because they come to you in a form that you recognize, that's the point. They, you know, certain beings, we'll call them tricksters or entities or things
like that.
Absolutely. They will come to you in a form that they believe will get to you the most. So they know what kind of religion you're in. They know what kind of angels you like. They know your family members. Yes. They know the family members that have passed away. So they will come in those forms. And this is the whole kind of shamanic understanding, is that you don't give your power to anything. Okay.
Right.
You know,
zero
there's a story.
Consent.
You don't give your power to anything.
Yeah.
And you don't get pulled anywhere. And and I'll get a lot of hate for this, but it has to be said, a lot of people that channel.
Mm.
And I've seen this happen to so many people because I've been here for so long. And I've seen channelers come in with like, you know, this is the person I'm channeling. And they'll give the most incredibly detailed channels. They'll blow your mind. And then 10 years later, the person is, they've lost their personality. They're only this channel. And
yep.
Now the channeling is god awful, terrible channeling. And you realize that, you know, this is kind of like a mind virus. It's an entity that's slowly taken this person over, you know. And so there's a lot of bad information out there, passed off as spiritual information coming from different channels.
Yeah.
And this is what I warn people about in the book, and that you have to kind of hold your sovereignty, hold your power.
That's right.
And that, you know, I write about examples of like, let's say like someone very close to you coming to you in the astral to talk to you. And quickly you realize that this conversation is kind of strange. It's not really what your friend would be talking to you about or your family talking to you about. And you're just kind of, you stop the conversations and go like, who are you really? Like,
yeah.
Show your true form.
Yeah.
And the disguise kind of goes away and you're like, get out of here. Like, what? Never come here again. And, you know, there's other stories in the book where I talk about, it's a really, I won't really get too much into it because it's a really bad experience. But basically when I popped out of my body to see what was happening to me, the being looked like an angel. It was like a glowing, beautiful white light thing. And, you know, what dawned on me was, holy shit. Like, if I wasn't aware of what I know, and if somebody came and saw this being, they would get down on their knees and start praying. And anything this being would say, they would listen to as like word from God.
Absolutely.
And that is extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
It will cost you your life. And I'm not joking about it. It will cost you your life.
Jason, these are some of the things that I bring up whenever we talk about things like CE5 protocols on this show. You know, it's one of those, it's the same thing whenever we talk about paranormal investigation, you know, and just the idea of, are you even charging the location with intent before you get there? Like, you should really just be going scientifically down a checklist of gear that you're bringing and not like reading stories about the location, reading accounts about the, like, all you're doing is polishing the filter through which you're going to look at all your data at that point,
and,
you know?
And this is
what I love.
But
you could also be manifesting something.
Yes.
And the idea that when you're out in the woods by yourself, when you're in these locations by yourself, yes, I believe, and I'll use my rote phrase here, audience, I believe that there is a large hominid creature roaming the woods of North America and beyond. But I also believe that there is something else out there that will gladly use the trope of your mind to make you think you saw that large hominid creature because that's what you would be comfortable with. And as soon as you go, oh, wow, that's awesome, you've now given your consent. You've consented into that spiritual system at that point. And if that's what that entity is looking for through that disguise, you've now given it an egress. Or entrance, rather, not egress. You know? you've given your consent at that point by being excited about it. No different than a CE5 experience and a plasma craft appearing in front of you, you know? And I've been on an ayahuasca journey. I've done my fair share of mushrooms, things like that. I remote view that kind of stuff, but I've definitely attempted astral travel. But I consider myself very, very well grounded in a lot of other ways. And it's also one of those, I am not going with that kind of intent. You know, that's, I'm not putting that out there in that kind of way. Like at one point I had designed them, man, Curious Realm answer boards for pendulums. And I was going to have a friend of mine burn them out on wood. And I was like, I can't do that. Like, I responsibly can't do that. That'd be like having Ouija boards made.
Yeah.
You know, like, I can't encourage everybody to go out and use a Ouija board because not everybody's spiritually founded enough to use a Ouija board properly.
Yeah, but who's teaching what we're talking about?
Yes.
Nobody.
Yeah.
You know, and it's no fault of anybody else.
No.
I mean, but there is an ignorance out there of, you know, calling on certain things. They have no clue what they're inviting.
Yeah.
And it, you know, what you're talking about, those things are extremely difficult to get rid of. And you need like professional, like the shamanic level professional. And even then it will be difficult.
Yeah. You need real energy workers at that point to get rid of something.
So we really do, we're not taught about these things that we play with all the time. And then when it does happen to us, then they just put us, you know, on medication or put us away somewhere and say, this guy, you know, I want to share something. Cause please, like I knew please. Some, or I didn't knew someone. No, I know someone, their father was a sheriff. All right. And it's like, they would go to, let's say, like a homicide. They'll go to someone's house and the parents are murdered, like in a really bad way. And it's done by like a child. And the child is literally like possessed in the literal sense.
Yeah.
And the cops know that this stuff happens, but they can't do anything about it. They'll just kind of write it up so that they know that this kid will never get out again and fear that this will happen again.
Mm.
That it's already open to this kind of suggestion.
Yeah.
So it's put away and hidden from us. But people know that this happens. So we are playing with dangerous things. And this is why I think this book is so important, because we have to understand that there's this whole other world out there. And when we have no knowledge of this world, it plays us. It tries to get close to us. It tries to possess us. It tries to take over us. It tries to take our energy. And, you know, you could say, well, you know, doesn't God protect you? Doesn't, you know, God do this? I'll tell you from my experience, it is God that's doing this to you. there's nobody else. It is God doing this to you.
Yeah.
And you have to figure that out, because God will not send anything that you can't handle. And it's always a teaching and a way of growth, you know? So when you look at the really dark and terrible things that have happened to you throughout your life, they've forced you to change.
Yeah.
Love and light doesn't force you to change. It's the dark shit that forces you to change.
That's right.
Because you don't want the dark shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, to take that one step further with it, it's the fact of, once again, you have consented into something, which is why this is happening to you. Even if you consented into the challenge, you know, even if you consented into the, please challenge my faith, you know, like the example I give regularly is Job. Like that poor dude, like he wasn't even a Jew. He just appreciated God, you know, and he's like, look at this guy. He's so great. The devil pops up and goes, oh, yeah, I bet I could jack with him. All right. But you can't kill him. Like the rules changed rapidly and regularly in that game, you know, and that's the thing, is that the universe plays by a different set of rules than we do and than physicality does.
We don't even know the rules. Yeah. That's the problem.
Oh, we're monkeys with guns, dude, when it comes to spirituality.
And, you know, you have to go through this experience to understand the rules. Like years and years ago, I was doing this session with someone. We were working with shamans and we were pulling an entity out of somebody.
Mm.
I don't usually talk about this type of work publicly, but we were pulling an entity out and, you know, there was someone that could communicate with this entity, and the entity wouldn't let go. It wouldn't come out. And they're just like, why are you not leaving? And they say, the entity said, I want to leave, but the person is holding on to me. And until they let go of me, I'm going to make their life a living hell.
That's right. Yeah.
And we're like, well, how is this person holding on to you? Okay. Maybe they have an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have an obsession.
Yep.
Maybe they have this thing that keeps them constantly in a pattern that holds this entity within them. And until you fix that pattern or you fix whatever that addiction or obsession is, you could pull that entity out a million times. It doesn't make a difference.
That's
it's going to come right back.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's very much as someone who suffered through addiction. It's one of those. That's why until that addict is ready to change themselves, you could have 18 interventions a week if you wanted to. It ain't going to do nothing until they are ready. Because they have to be the one to release that. They have to be the one to say, literally that first step, it is untenable for me. I accept that's a power right. greater than my own, because obviously mine is not powerful enough to conquer this.
And I like to call them, and this is like from my own experience, I like to call them placeholders.
Mm.
So all this negative crap that we hold on to, I just call them placeholders. They're place holding us in a pattern, our personality, our path in life. And until we're ready to release some of these placeholders, then we can change a little here and a little there.
Yeah. Yeah. And change is always possible. That's the beautiful thing, is that we are malleable beings. Our brains are malleable in so many different ways. So you can change and polish the different facets of your life throughout your life and keep doing it. Like I said earlier, the minute you stop asking questions, you should really like not be breathing anymore. That's how it's supposed to work. You're supposed to question everything all the time, and always be curious. And I love the way that your brain works and the way that your soul works with this, Jason, because it really is the fact of there is as Art Bell used to put it, there is a quickening upon us right now. There's something happening, and a lot of it has to do with our connection, you know, our different and very visceral connection to each other, because we did not used to be connected this way. Even in ancient societies, we were more connected to the stars and things like that, because without that, we didn't eat. You didn't know the constellations, and when they rose and set, you didn't know when to put seed in the ground or when to move to hunt a certain animal that your village ate, you know? But we're connected in a way now that is very visceral and 100% emotional, and in a way that we have never been connected, you know, where literally you wake up with the news from Poughkeepsie in the palm of your hand, you know, and that affects us in a different way and puts us at a state of being uneven, and we have to find an even keel with all this. So your work in this area is very, very important, my friend. So thank you so much for doing it and for sharing these experiences that you've had over the years and these points of connection, because if we don't learn to realize them, much like any good cyclical pattern, we will repeat them. It's only a matter of time before we repeat them. So, go ahead.
This is all we can do, is we can open and share honestly and, hope, like, I wish I had this book when I was going through my thing.
Yeah.
You know, it would have changed a lot. It took me like many years to figure this stuff out. So,
well, it is a beautiful compilation, man. And really, really a great telling of this truth of, not just a modern society going through this, but ancient societies becoming modern and how we all tie together and how shamanic knowledge and shamanic healing is necessary in everyday life. It's not just like something that you do at a metaphysical seminar on a Saturday. You know, it's something that you constantly curate. So thank you for your time today, man. And thank you for honestly sharing everything. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to get all of your books, where they can go to follow your work, and where they can go to see you, because you're actively at a couple of really large conferences this year where people can check you out and come hear you speak about all this.
Sure. My personal website is thecrystalsun.com, which is what you're showing, but you can get all my books on Amazon. Doesn't matter where you are, amazon.com. And I'm going to be speaking at Contact in the Desert at the end of May, first weekend of, oh, that one is done.
Yes, it is.
That one down. Got to switch it up. But Contact in the Desert in Palm Springs, the first or the last weekend of May, first weekend of June. And then I'm also doing a MUFON symposium in Cincinnati, which is July 17th to the 20th. And that is the latest schedule. And please, I'm very proud of the new book. Finally, I can tell these stories without fear, judgment, and all these things. I'm happy to share it all with you.
Well, thank you so much for sharing, and thank you so much for your amazing, amazing work, man. Truly, it's phenomenal, the stuff that you put out. So thank you for everything that you do. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online at Jason's website, thecrystalsun.com, picking up your new copy of Astral Experiences, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find, CuriousRealm.com is where you can find all of the events that we do that we're a part of. That's where you can find all of our guests' books, all the books by Jason Quitt and other guests, as well as films, movies, classes. That's also where you can get your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log if you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFO, ufology. This is your pocket data log to put down all of your data in the field in real time so that you have good scientific data to shake hands with science come the day that you need to do so. Thank you so much for your time tonight, everybody. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.